This week on Art of the Air, our whole show features Chief Curator and Visual Arts Director of the National Museum of Mexican Art, Cesario Moreno, discussing his own art journey and his responsibility overseeing the permanent collection and the numerous exhibits for the museum. Our spotlights on South Shore Orchestra's Summer Symphonic Spectacular on June 20th at Valparaiso Central Park with Maestro Troy Waddell.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. Hello, I'm Larry Breckner, Board Chair for Lakeshore Public Media and also a sustaining supporter. As Northwest Indiana's public broadcaster on TV, radio, and digital, we're not only bringing you the best of PBS and NPR, but more importantly, serve as a vital community resource for great local programs like Regionally Speaking, Eye in the Arts, Friends and Neighbors, Let's Eat with Chef Nick, Art in the Air, Building Blocks, and more. Please help protect my Lakeshore Public Media with your support by visiting lakeshorepublicmedia.org/give. I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the South Shore Orchestra, and they'll be performing a new concert coming up on June 20th on Friday, 7 p.m. at Central Park Plaza. And of course, we have our maestro that's here, and he's been with us before, of course, for an in-depth interview, Troy Waddell. He's going to tell us a little about what South Shore Orchestra is doing and also the guest artists. Troy, welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me. We're doing, with South Shore Orchestra, another summer concert. We did a summer concert last year in Valparaiso Central Park, but actually that one got rained out. Oops. So hopefully this one will be happening in the park. If not, we always do the rain location at Valparaiso High School. So this one is June 20th at 7 o'clock p.m., and it's called Superman, Shostakovich, and Mozart's Clarinet. And it's kind of a big mix of pieces that feature superheroes or super people in music. So, of course, Mozart was a superhero composer, Shostakovich, a big superhero composer, and Superman, of course, is a Superman, but composed by John Williams, who is also a super composer. We're going to be having a wonderful clarinetist, Canadian clarinetist, Laurie Blanchet, is going to be coming to perform, and the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. So it should be a wonderful mixture of music, something for everyone.
Now, she's with your Fort Wayne Philharmonic Orchestra, is that correct?
She is the principal clarinetist with Fort Wayne Philharmonic, but she also regularly plays with Chicago Symphony. She'll sub in. She's done that several times recently. So you may see her in Fort Wayne. You may see her in Chicago. You may see her in Canada playing. You may, but if you are in Valparaiso on June 20th, you will see her with us, South Shore Orchestra.
So was this pairing your inspiration?
Yes. I wanted to put together music that was kind of meaningful for the time. Also, a connection to the 80th anniversary of World War II, which the Shostakovich Symphony No. 9 is. Shostakovich was basically told to write a huge symphony celebrating the end of World War II. He was told this by Joseph Stalin, which you probably know as the dictator in Russia at the time. And Shostakovich, although he wanted to write something for the end of World War II, he did not want to appease Stalin. So he started to write this big piece with chorus, orchestra, very much like the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, which is what Stalin wanted. But then secretly he wrote the real Ninth Symphony, which as you're going to hear on June 20th. And the real Ninth Symphony is more reminiscent of circus music. So no chorus, shorter length. It's probably his shortest symphony, and just real fun music. So it's kind of, Stalin was not very happy when he heard this performed, because he was expecting this big piece of music.
So does the title indicate the way we're going to hear the music?
No, Shostakovich will be last. Yes. Okay. So Superman will open up, you know, kind of like a big patriotic type thing, and then into Mozart's clarinet concerto, which was the first concerto written for clarinet ever. So Mozart kind of wrote it for a different type of clarinet, which they had back then, but it's been adapted for the modern clarinet.
So what's the challenges of performing outdoors versus, of course, in a hall or symphony hall or auditorium?
Well, definitely the weather. That's one. But then also there are things like the acoustics. Sometimes it's, you know, if the wind blows a certain way, you might not hear something that you heard in rehearsal. So those types of things. Now, we will have a sound person who will do his magic and make everything sound, you know, perfectly out where you're going to be sitting.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, humidity's got to be a big issue, too, especially for some of the instruments. So I imagine the woodwinds that use reeds, that's got to affect it dramatically.
Yes, humidity. A lot of the wind instruments, especially, are used to playing outside in the summer. There are several summer bands in the area that they play in also. A lot of our musicians play in other groups throughout the area, which is kind of a nice thing.
This has been your association with the South Shore Orchestra, but tell us some of the things that you've been doing also beyond that.
Well, I'm also a conductor with the Fort Wayne Philharmonic. And with that, I conduct many different concerts, including the Family Series, which I have kind of recreated there based on children's books. So all the concerts are connected to a certain children's book, and the music kind of goes with that. But it's not just children's music, you know, you hear that term, but it's masterworks music put to a family concert, basically.
Right. And how many concerts a year do you do there in Fort Wayne?
With the Philharmonic, I'll conduct around 10 to 15 concerts.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a lot. They do a lot of concerts.
Very art-rich community, Fort Wayne. I like it a lot.
Yeah, and it's a full-time orchestra, so they're playing most of the year.
Well, in our final minute here, can you remind everyone where the concert is, what's on the schedule one more time, Troy?
Yes, we have Superman, Shostakovich, and Mozart's clarinet with the South Shore Orchestra on Friday, June 20th at 7 o'clock p.m. in Valparaiso Central Park. There will be food trucks and all kinds of fun things for you. Just bring a lawn chair and come and enjoy the music.
And if you get rained out, where do you go?
Valparaiso High School is our rain location.
Excellent. Well, we're glad to have you back on the show and touch base with us about the South Shore Orchestra. And again, just hitting it again Friday, June 20th, 7 p.m. Central Park in Valparaiso. Troy, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air Spotlight and sharing your upcoming concert.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maestro.
Thank you.
And a Spotlight Extra. Artists may enter two pieces of their artwork for the Chesterton Women's Club Art Show on June 3rd at 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Chesterton Art Center, and the show runs June 5th through the 28th. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com.
This is Janet Davies, formerly of ABC7 and now the Dunes Arts Foundation, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Cesario Moreno to Art on the Air. Cesario has been with the National Museum of Mexican Art since 1992. He has been the visual arts director since 1995 and was named the museum's first full-time chief curator in 2004. He has curated numerous exhibitions for the NMMA, as well as many in museums and cultural centers around the country, and has served as a juror and panelist for many groups. A talented educator, Cesario also serves on the City of Chicago's Cultural Advisory Committee and the Memorial and Monuments Advisory Committee. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Cesario. It's so fantastic meeting you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, we'd like to have you on the show. And usually what we like to start off with is our guest's origin story. And I always tee it up by saying how you got from where you were to where you're now. So tell us all about Cesario.
Sure. First of all, thank you for asking. I think it does sort of shed a little bit of light on the institution that I work for, that I've worked at for 33 years now. You know, my family first got to Chicago, immigrants from Mexico. They got here in 1944, and I was born a couple of decades later, born and raised in Chicago. So the funny thing about that is in the home, it was Mexico. So Spanish was my first language, the food, the music, the celebrations. It was very, very Mexican on the north side of the city of Chicago. And of course, when I would leave for school every day, I would walk outside and I was no longer in that environment. I was in a city of neighborhoods, a city of immigrants. And of course, it was a German, Irish north side parish where I grew up. So there were two. Sort of two places that really influenced me, the home and the outside. And every summer, I would go down to Mexico and spend the whole summer with aunts and uncles and cousins down there. So that happened all the way through high school. Actually, even maybe a couple of 1 or 2 years of college, I was continually traveling down to Mexico. And so that is where my understanding of Mexican culture really came from the Bajio area, this in the state of Guanajuato, central, very much like the Midwest of Mexico. And so I always had this connection with my culture and the history of where my family came from. You know, and then college started, and I was actually in the seminary for a couple of years. I was in the seminary during high school, and then 2 years of college. And
what informed that choice?
Sure, what informed that choice? Well, you know, my faith was always a part of the family, right? We were, and if you really look at Mexican culture. A lot of it is based on biblical stories and celebrations that are very Christian. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Easter and Christmas and many, many, many more. So I think that I really connected with the Catholic religion in a way that it made sense of the way that we celebrated and the way that we lived. You know, even to this day, Day of the Dead is an important event in Mexican communities. And certainly that has a lot of pre-Christian, but also a lot of Catholic ideas behind it. So the Mexican culture has always been sort of a thin veil over a lot of Christian cultural mm-hmm. ideas. So I think that's it. It felt right. It felt right.
So it wasn't like a familial, it wasn't a familial expectation necessarily. It was just something that you personally felt. Okay.
Yes. It was totally my choice. There was no pressure whatsoever. Actually, quite the opposite. I think some in my family were hoping that I would one day have a family, right? Which is also a very important Mexican aspect. So I went to Rome for a year, not in the seminary, but at the Loyola Rome Center. And I came back after that year and decided that the seminary life wasn't for me, right? There were other ways in which I could accomplish the things that I wanted to do, and most of that would probably fall under social justice. Right. At that time in the Catholic Church, liberation theology was very strong, and it was really a way of understanding the world that we live in. And those sorts of ideas, I realized I could do them outside of an organized religion. I could do them outside of the Catholic institution.
That's the beauty of everything, though, isn't it? Parlaying the things that are deeply important to us, but channeling them in something that feels right, I guess.
Discovering how they may exist or manifest themselves in other parts of our life, right? Or in other ways. So I graduated a degree in philosophy. And then after a couple of years, I realized I need to go back to school and continue to pursue things that I love, right? So I went to School of the Art Institute for graduate school. And then the semester or the year that I was about to graduate from SAIC, I visited this little new museum that was barely like 5 years old in the Pilsen neighborhood. And I went in there and I really, really loved what they were doing, how they were doing it. It brought together my knowledge and appreciation of Mexican culture and history. It brought it together with the fine arts that I was studying. But it also had this idea of social justice and community work, which really tapped into the third leg of my view, if we could use that analogy or that metaphor. Then I started hanging out at the museum. I volunteered. I was invited to exhibit in an exhibit in 1991, I think it was. And then by 1992, they asked me to join the team at the museum. Back then, it was mostly to help with exhibitions, installation, opening crates, moving crates. And then the big
That's how ask. It all starts.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah, I literally walked into this museum job through the back door, not knowing at all that it would be a 33-year job.
It's glorious.
Yeah, it's fun the way things surprise you, right, in life. The big ask was what I was asked to travel with an exhibition that they had just curated. And it was going to go to 7 cities. It was going to go to Oaxaca, Mexico City, Tijuana, New York, San Francisco. It was going to travel for 3 years. And they asked me to travel with it, both to install it and then back install it and then go to the next city. So at each city, I was going for maybe 2 or 3 weeks on both ends of the exhibition. That was my real museum training. After traveling with that exhibit for 3 years, I realized I could keep doing this. It's so much fun. I enjoy traveling. I enjoy meeting new people who are very creative and think outside the box. And, you know, it really sort of, for the first time, dawned on me that this would be a good full-time job for a while. You know, here we are 3 decades later. I'm still enjoying it. I'm still loving to travel, meet interesting people, And there's so much variety in what we do here and what I do here.
Oh, every single day.
I wear
day.
Many hats. Yes. Yeah. And so I have really been honored to be a part of such an institution like this, that brings together so many of the important things for me, that exist in my life or in this life.
So, you know, since you mentioned the School of the Art Institute, I want to go mm-hmm. back to childhood. And what was it like in the household? What was your arts like then? What were you doing? What were you interested in? Was your family, was there a lot of creative energy in the family? Were the grandparents around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Big question.
Yeah, yeah. No, yes, no. There was creativity throughout my family, meaning... my uncles, and my aunt, they knew how to play music. They could play any string instrument, you name it, they could play it. They knew many songs back when they were working, in North Dakota, in the sugar beet industry, big parties, and they were the musicians. They were the people would come. To see them play. So the music was a big thing. And a good number of them, I'm going to say maybe three or four of them, they knew how to draw really, really well. Like they were, I remember seeing them draw. I remember learning from them at the kitchen table. I remember seeing their sketches and just being amazed at how they could draw something that would, and it would look just like that person, right? They were self-taught. These are farmers. They're people who they're farm hands, basically.
Yeah. Observers,
they know
though.
How to. Yes. Yeah. And, but they knew how to, they had that skill. And so because of that, I was always drawing, you know, at home, at school, even in high school, I was kind of known as the artist who would, draw the yearbook cover or draw for the school newspaper, do the backdrops for the plays, that kind of thing. So I was always drawing and painting and creating work throughout my youth. So yeah, and it was always encouraged. It wasn't discouraged. It wasn't seen as you know something. It wasn't seen necessarily as just something that's a pastime. It was understood to be a talent, and it ran in my family. Yeah.
And so then when you went to the school of with the Art Institute of Chicago, mm-hmm. what were you working on? Were you drawing? Were you painting? Were you doing sculpture?
So I did go there thinking that painting and drawing is art, right? My education really hadn't involved installations or sculptures, things like that. So I went there thinking I was going to draw and paint, and then just fell in love with, kinetic sculpture. That's by the time I graduated, that's what I was making. I was making objects and things that moved or had lights. It had electricity. It had motors. And so by the time I left School of the Art Institute, I think I really knew how to fabricate and how to make things, which is why I was able to, do installation work so well at the museum when I first started. I knew how to use a hammer, a drill, a level, a table saw, those kinds of things. And that really helped me. That really, it allowed me to create different things and also work on utilitarian projects or just install other people's artwork. Yeah.
Right. So that's your entry to the museum. And how did, you know, now, how did the rest happen? How did you become chief curator? What were the steps?
Well, it was definitely on the job training.
Yeah.
I met so many other curators whose work I really, really appreciated. I met many artists also whose work I appreciated, meaning not just the actual piece, but what they were saying, what the piece meant. And so I little by little started making my inroads there. I think one of the first exhibits I did was a folk art exhibit, and then a Day of the Dead exhibit. And certainly both of those topics I understood them almost intuitively. I understood Mexican folk art intuitively. I understood the Day of the Dead and the meaning behind it, both on a personal as well as on a community level. So curating those initial exhibits really gave me a sense of confidence. So little by little, my horizons expanded. I learned so much more about the history of Mexico, which is so profound. I learned quite a bit more about my community's history in the city of Chicago, when they arrived, how they arrived, what they did when they first got here. And it paralleled my own family's immigration story to the city of Chicago. So I did understand all these exhibits and ideas step by step, and then really fell in love with researching and learning those aspects that that I did not know.
You know, the museum, you know, what I think bigger than that, what it did, especially for me being a folk artist or a textile artist, when in the 60s and the 70s, it was like little C craft, you know, mm-hmm. and very disregarded. And what the museum did was it brought it up into the finest word of craft then. And it really just improved every mm-hmm. folk textile artist's life from, you know, right. the minute it opened, because it really did say, look at this.
Right.
And I know you weren't chief curator when it opened, but I know what the museum did for me was it just was such a comprehensive experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the mixture of like, here's an emerging artist, here's the history of Mexico, here's, you know, here's artifacts. It just really was so welcoming and mm-hmm. comfortable. So yeah. I just, yeah.
That's a very good word, the all-encompassing idea. Because, you know, ultimately, being creative, a lot of people like to divide into folk art and fine art.
Right.
And those two categories really, they do a disservice, right? It's the folk artist and the artist, they sit side by side. They tackle the same issues. They resolve them in similar ways. But at the end of the day, one of them signs the work of art and it goes off to an art market, right? So the art market is says it has more value. And then the other one doesn't necessarily sign the work, but it falls into this sort of folk art craft area. And so familiar, it sort of loses value on the art market. And that's very unfair. That's very unfair. We here at the museum display the works side by side. We mm-hmm. show the relationship between the artist and the traditional artist. They inspire one another. I mean, I've seen at Schoolyard Institute or read about artists whose inspiration is the folk artist and vice versa. So we always do try to present the visual arts as having a symbiotic relationship, and oftentimes folk art and fine art are the exact same thing.
I was actually going to ask about your own art practice, though. What are now that you're curating and doing things, do you have time to even do an art practice?
No, that's the short answer, no. But, you know, curating exhibits, doing the research, finding the works that tell the story, it is a very creative work, right? It satisfies the need that I have to be creative. Ultimately, what a curator does is we are preserving the past and bringing it to the present so that it will continue into the future. And that's basically telling a story. So storytelling with other works of art and artifacts and objects is a very creative endeavor. It when an exhibit opens, I truly feel that I have been a part of this creative process. And so that is fulfilling. So I don't necessarily need to be creating kinetic sculptures any longer or doing prints or drawings. I am thoroughly satisfied curatorial process.
Yeah, it's extremely fulfilling. So now that you are chief curator and you're happily enmeshed in other things in the city, you know, you're on these advisory committees, you're giving incredible lectures. I mean, I listen to so many of them. You are a very captivating speaker. I learned so much just from the brief interviews that I was looking at. So you've got all of that going on. So what is your year mapped out for finding new artists or discovering what you want to do next? It just seems like there's not enough hours.
You are absolutely correct. You know, we have our main gallery exhibits planned out now until 2028. So those exhibits, we know they're coming. We know the themes, and especially the contemporary exhibitions. It is always exciting, and it's not a challenge. There's so many artists out there to choose from. And of course, being the National Museum of Mexican Art, we often look for works of art coming across the country or coming from Mexico, south of the border. So it's a lot of territory to cover. There are so many artists with different points of view and perspective. The trick is, it's kind of like organizing a wedding, right? Who are you going to sit together at table number one? And then at table number two, you'll want them to get along. Maybe they don't know each other, right? But you want them to get along and have a beautiful conversation among themselves. That's the way I see it when I organize or curate an exhibit. I want the works that have been grouped together to really respond to one another and sing with one voice so that our visitors who come through hear them loud and clear.
That is the goal. Yes, I completely agree with that. And I've even had artists like say, no, I don't, I wouldn't put that together. And I'm like, oh, but wait and see, you know, I hear it differently than you see it. So.
And after a brief pause, we'll return to our guest today on Art on the Air, Cesario Moreno. Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners. Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. This is Pledge Week for your public radio station, and Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program. We return to Art in the Air with our guest, Cesario Moreno, Chief Curator and Visual Arts Director for the National Museum of Mexican Art. And we'll continue our conversation with him.
Yeah, you know, hanging a show for me, Cesario, is a very intimate process. I surround myself with the work, and then that puzzle or the chatter begins with the work. Can you speak to the way you work putting an exhibition together?
Sure. You know, oftentimes I feel as though I am organizing a wedding. In other words, you have X amount of tables, and those would probably be the sections within the exhibition. And at each table, you want to seat people who are going to have a great conversation and enjoy each other's company. And even if they may not know each other, first time they're getting to know each other, it needs to go off seamlessly. And so I guess sometimes you put people together who may not think that they should be seated together. They don't know each other, certainly. But that makes for a much nicer get together, right? That experience. And so when I'm organizing an exhibition, when I'm curating it, I'm always thinking about what piece will be near this or next to it, and how will that carry the narrative. The main concern for me is that the storyline, the subject matter, what we are trying to explain or what we are trying to celebrate is really coherent. And oftentimes I think as a curator, you see all the works and the artists that you're putting together in an exhibition, And you just have to trust that the story you are, I'm just going to use the word writing, even though we're not really writing.
No, you're revealing it.
There you go. Revealing. The story you're revealing really is flawless. And sometimes an incredible work of art might steal the show a little bit. And it may also sort of be an interruption in the narrative. So knowing where to place it, how to place it, so that they sort of fortify one another and they collaborate together. Maybe it's also like an orchestra, right? Where you know when a certain instrument must come in and then when it needs to stop and let another one sort of come in. So I think of it as the most important thing is the narrative. What is being expressed or explained and how to best do that using works of art, objects, or artifacts.
And do you do that on your own, or do you collaborate with the artist as to, because like sometimes what you see as the most important piece might not be how they mm-hmm. how they felt about it. So what is your interaction with them?
If it's a solo one-person exhibit, I will certainly take into account what the artist thinks or says or believes. And usually that's explained to me by the artist. In their studio space. And that's where I kind of learn which one is that artist's favorite piece, you know, right now, and which is the piece that they felt was a signature work for them. And I will definitely keep that in mind. And so, I definitely do not want to encourage or invite the artist in during the installation.
Right.
Because oftentimes that might lead to conversations that just slow the whole thing down. But if an artist were to come in after everything is pretty much laid out and really make the case that this piece should not be there, that's never happened, by the way. But if in a one person show, if that were to happen, I think I would certainly take it into account. In group shows, however, I'll do the layout, but then I do ask people whose opinion I trust. And that would be my peers, and just say, you know, do you think it's okay if we put this piece here? Does it feel right? Does it not? So I don't do it all by myself. I reach out, ask for advice, figure things out, and then just kind of move forward that way.
You know, at some point I would like, and this is kind of me speaking as a photographic artist, when I'm in a group show, and this is sort of personal, I sort of like when my pieces are grouped together, but I know sometimes they don't happen that way, but then the curator does it. So what's the process on that? Like on your end of it, you know, as a curator, I know I like that. Sure. Right now I'm in a show for the area artists, and they did that specifically for every artist. They grouped each one together because that's kind of the theme of that. But how do you approach an artist that way?
Yeah, no, I agree. I tend to, so again, it's not always, but I tend to group the work of one artist, you know, right next to each other in a group, so that the visitors, the people that walk through the museum, they get a sense of who this person is, how they work, what they do. However, if it is an exhibition where the topics are more important, the subject matter, so let's say we're doing something that deals with food, with architecture, and with, customs and festivals, obviously, If an artist has work in each section, I would split it up and follow the sections. And that's just part of the storytelling, right? So I don't have a problem splitting up the work by one artist if it tells the story better in different sections.
Right.
But my go-to is usually to cluster them next to each other so that people really get into this person's creative mind and understand where she or he is coming from.
Yeah. Depends on what makes sense in each instance.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
So what is your day like when you, what is your day like?
Yeah.
Let's leave it there.
Yeah. Since we're talking about curating and installation in that part, let's keep it at that, because I never know what's going to happen in any given day, which is, I actually do enjoy that. I sort of thrive on the different tasks and roles. I may be on a ladder one day. I may be in a studio another day.
There's a lot of different things that need to be done to put up a successful exhibition. But during installation time, you know, I've gotten to see the works beforehand, always in person. You know, it may start out online, visiting a website of a given artist or a museum. But then I need to see the piece in person, because that's where you really understand the work. When nothing can compare to standing in front of a piece where you can really see the material, you can see the surface, you can see how the paint
strokes
applied. Yes, exactly. So sometimes that's what makes the decision, right? So maybe this ceramic piece actually goes best with a painting because of the way the surface was treated. Right. And so after seeing the pieces and doing the layout on paper, I obviously on the computer, but I also like to print it out and then take a pencil and work with it that way. That's I guess that says more about my generation than anything else. I like working on paper. And then once the works are all here at the museum, then we lay them out section by section. And then before they are installed by the installation crew, we really do a walkthrough one more time just to make sure that all those works of art are getting along. Again, right. Going back to the analogy of the wedding, right? You want to make sure that whoever you sit next to your Aunt Minnie is going to, have fun with her and not sort of conflict. So, and then oftentimes too, once you're in the space, you see a work of art and you realize this is not a good place in the corner because the subject matter is looking to the left or to the right, and somehow you want to come out of the corner, and so and it's something that you didn't realize,
right?
Or just the reality.
It's kind of like an electric connection almost. I see it like very much like electricity.
sure, or the piece is large, and it's underneath one of the fire alarms, the red. Fire alarms that are, you know, all over the buildings in the museum. And then you just realize, oh, this is not going to work here. You look at the painting and your eye follows the person's hat or what they're wearing. And then you look up and there's this big red fire alarm. So simple things like that are the space interacting with the work. So there are a lot of things to sort of keep in mind that way.
So this is an odd question. Do you change the color of your walls for the
goodness.
Exhibit?
Yes. Yes. We are known since the 80s when we opened. We are known for our palettes.
Beautiful.
Our walls
They
are almost never white. And if they are white, it's very intentional. But we always do look at the work. That I do count on other people's eye. Color is not one of my strengths, but we have many people here who really have an incredible sense of color. And sometimes they'll pick a color that at first, when you're looking at the little color chip, just seems so wrong. And then once it's on the wall and then the work is placed up against it, it sings. And
it's so enhancing.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's the other thing too. I think one of the important things that I fully believe in is that we should not be distracting from the artwork. Mm-hmm. Our role is kind of like, what do they call them in theater? You're working in the background, you're dressed in black and no one is supposed to see you, like the sets, changing the sets around. So I feel that mounts, risers, platforms, wall color, even graphic texts, they're there to enhance the visitor's experience and learning, but certainly not meant to compete with any of the artwork. The artwork and the artists are the stars. That's who is telling our story, and our role is to connect one piece to another or one section to another, and maybe answer some questions along the way. But the artwork, that's why people come. That's why people come to the museum, to see the artwork. Certainly not to read my labels.
So
So tell us about how long exhibits, generally speaking, are in your space, and do you have multiple exhibits? How, you know, deciding that process, like, you know, who you're going to have in, what, how long that exhibit's going to be, and selection of artists, how that all process happens. Yeah.
So the exhibitions committee meets as needed, and that probably comes out to 4 times a year. We plan out in advance. So right now, we're set through 2027 and already have solid ideas about 2028. That's the main gallery. The smallest gallery we have, which is for the local artists, we planned that about a year out in advance, just because local artists are not very happy when you tell them they have an exhibit 3 years from now. And so they want to show the work that they're doing, the recent things. And so we turn that gallery over a little bit quicker. We don't plan it out as far. We have 3 galleries that we rotate exhibitions. So that means that we have 6 exhibits every year, 2 exhibits in each gallery. And then we have our permanent gallery, which we change out pieces. So if we receive a new work of art, we will, you know, we'll try to get that in somewhere. If we can swap it out with a work of art that you know is comparable, and it doesn't change the narrative that much, but rather, you know, continues it, we'll do that. But the 6 exhibits, we really look at everything from ancient Mesoamerican exhibits coming from Mexico. So we recently did an exhibit on the Huasteca women of Mexico. So these are pieces that are, you know, what were they from, like 500 BCE. And so we have that exhibit. And then we also have exhibits that are more colonial, some that are more about folk art. And certainly we have many contemporary exhibits by living artists on both sides of the border. We really believe in cultura sin fronteras, which means culture has no borders. And so the Mexican experience of artists in the U.S., born in the U.S. of Mexican ancestry, or those from Mexico, we display both sides of the border, basically. So it keeps us busy. You know, some artists do site-specific installations that are a little bit more complicated, and sometimes, you know, we're bringing in bags of sand or broken glass or tree limbs, things like that. And then other times we're working with fragile ceramic pieces that are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years old, and everything in between. So we really try to rotate that, right? So we like it when we have ancient exhibits following contemporary exhibits, following traditional folk art exhibits. So we try to mix it up as much as possible, because we basically have 5,000 years of history and culture to draw from.
Right. Well, you're listening to our guest today, Cesario Marino, on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM, on Art on the Air.
Well, that is what I particularly love about the museum, is the mixture of all of those experiences in one place.
Yeah, and you know, and we try to show how they relate to one another. So we have no problem here putting up a folk art piece next to a fine art, you know, contemporary work, and then you turn the corner and there's an ancient piece from Mesoamerica. We try to explain the connections and the relationships that they have. I don't think it's a very difficult thing to do, because when I see these works, I certainly can see the connections that they have. Right. But sometimes it's not as obvious. And so that's when the texts and the gallery texts come into play.
And does every exhibit, and I don't mean like every single one, but like if you're doing a solo show or a group exhibit, are there always programs related to that happening with the artists?
So actually, that is more of a funding question for us. So the main gallery exhibits generally have more sponsorship. Funders come in, and so then the education department here at the museum does an incredible job of organizing events and activities that relate to the exhibition. In the smaller galleries where there is less funding, we don't necessarily do that. We'll invite the artist to come in and give a talk, some kind of a lecture, or we'll bring in an expert from Mexico, from one of the universities or one of the museums there, to shed light on the work. But we don't necessarily have as many activities planned around the smaller galleries.
Yeah, that's understandable. So you had mentioned that you view generally the work online first. Is that usually how it goes, or are you out in the public going to different exhibitions yourself?
Yeah, it's probably both, but certainly online it's the way things work now. You know, I was here when we would receive big manila envelopes and there would be a packet of slides. Yes. And there would be, you know, the bio or the resume would be typed up, and then we would have to fill the slide projector and make sure the orientation was correct. Image wasn't flip-flopped. And we would sit and go through all these slides to see what's out there. I do not miss those days. I do not miss them at all. So, you know, now somebody will email me the link and I'll go and flip through it and see. But ultimately, I think whether I'm visiting another museum, whether I'm visiting a studio, it's the exhibition that I'm curating that really selects the artwork. So I have said no to some incredibly beautiful works of art because they don't fit the story that we're saying. Sometimes it's difficult to tell the artist. It has more to do with the exhibition that we're doing than the artwork that you are creating. And so the selection of artwork is geared and determined according to the exhibition subject.
Now, I saw something on your website about theater, and then, of course, one part is, I think, Laura Baker. What does that have to do with your, what connection does that have to your facility?
So, you know, I do not pretend to understand or know the performing arts department here at the museum. They do a fantastic job. They do concerts and lectures and theater as well as film. Every now and then I'll go to one, but my hands are busy with the visual arts and the exhibitions. So I don't know, but you know, we've been hosting the Sor Juana Festival now for, it's gotta be almost, or at least 30 years, 25 to 30 years. And that really is a festival that focuses on the creative work of Mexican women.
Right.
And so, that has always been something that we do and enjoy doing. And sometimes if we can sort of dovetail an exhibition by a specific person that has something to do with one of the performances, that's when the museum is at its best, when different departments are working together or landing on the same sort of ideas. And then the visitors really, really get a well-rounded experience of the creativity of these artists. But that doesn't always happen.
So they do perform in your space, though?
Yes, we have a multi-use space on the west wing of the museum. It has a stage, and we have had people there from Sandra Cisneros, Ana Castillo, Elena Poniatowska from Mexico. Many authors and scholars, Octavio Paz and Rigoberta Menchú have been on that stage. So I'm really proud of the lineup of people that we have had come through here through the performing arts.
Well, in our final minute here, we just want to give you a chance to say what's coming up. This will end air in the end of May, but things that you might be coming up in the year, like summer and upcoming.
Sure. Well, right now I am working feverishly with the team on our annual Day of the Dead exhibit. This will be the 39th exhibition that opens this September. And it's for us, Day of the Dead is more of a season. It's not just a day. We have the festival at the end of October. We have the Day of the Dead Ball that we organize. And of course, the exhibition that brings in so many artists from across the U.S., Mexico, and of course, the Midwest. National Museum of Mexican Art. You can go to our website or our Instagram or the other social media handles that,
well,
that we
in
have.
Final minute and here, we're always doing great to things tell us how people
for
can
all
find
kinds
out
of families.
You
don't have to be Mexican.
Like that.
It is always free.
Sure, well,
and
National
Pilsen is such
Museum
a great neighborhood.
Mexican
after
art,
you come you do an activity or see an event or visit our galleries,
social media,
you're going to go outside that and you will find an incredible place to have a meal. So I invite people to come down to Pilsen, to come to the Mexican Museum.
Always free.
And again, it's always free. There's no reason not to come.
Do an activity. It sounds great. We appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. Cesario Moreno. He's the National Museum of Mexican Art chief curator for a long, long time. Thank you for us coming on Art in the Air and sharing your arts journey and your curating journey.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was completely wonderful. We'll have to have you back. This was too short.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.